Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, Nepal dismisses a United Nations war crimes report. The 10th anniversary of the Bali bombing is under threat, say reliable sources. And just as Australia did recently, the United States warns Chinese telecom companies pose a threat to national security. We have this and more on this edition of the program. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Nepal's government has rejected a United Nations report urging to take action against those responsible for serious human rights violations during the country's civil war. The Nepal conflict report, released by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights earlier this week, documents thousands of cases of human rights violations from the beginning of the conflict in 1996 until a peace accord was signed in 2006. Liam Cochrane speaks next to Rory Mungrovan, the head of the agency's Asia-Pacific section.
The High Commissioner for Human Rights maintained an office in Nepal for 7 years from 2005, and in the course of that work, we collected a huge amount of documentation, testimony, stories from victims from the conflict period, which had been the 10 years, really, from 1996 till the peace accords were signed in 2006. It is very important to preserve all of that testimony and evidence for the future, for any future inquiry, investigation, research, truth process, and ultimately prosecution of some of those crimes. And we felt a great responsibility to, preserve and catalogue the archive of more than 30,000 documents we'd built up and present them in a usable form to the people of Nepal, in a form that, civil society, the government, the judiciary, the National Human Rights Commission and others could use to pursue some of these cases and issues further.
And I'm presuming this is evidence and testimony of things that happen on both sides of the conflict.
In the archive, which, as I say, covers about 30,000 documents, there's probably 9,000 or so, individual or separate cases of human rights violations documented there. And, not all of these are the result of our investigation, so we can't vouch for every report, but each of them has been included because it represents a very credible allegation that deserves further investigation, that deserves further inquiry. The violations were committed on both sides. The patterns that are documented in the report include unlawful killing, disappearances, torture, arbitrary detention, even sexual violence. And they happened in different degrees of intensity at different phases of the conflict. For instance, disappearances, we see spikes during the first security operations against the Maoists in around 1998, when the armed police force was first mobilized as part of the campaign, and again in 2001 when the emergency was declared and the army was deployed against the Maoists, you see disappearances again spike. It also allows you to sort of map the geographic trends, where did this happen in the country at different times, and you again begin to see clusters of disappearances, spikes of disappearances in one district or another at particular times during the conflict, in Badia district, where there was a particularly intensive security operation to root out Maoists from about 2001 to 2003, more than 200 disappearance cases reported there in a couple of months. And by being able to analyse these patterns, these trends, you can begin to discern the responsibilities, who was in command at that time, what battalion was there, who is accountable. And this will be a very, very powerful tool in bringing these issues forward before a truth commission or before the Nepali courts.
One of the cases that's perhaps best documented by the UN is that of the Bharabhanat battalion in Kathmandu. And recently we've had news that the officer in charge of that battalion, which was alleged to have taken Maoists or suspected Maoists, tortured them, and they've since disappeared, presumed dead, that officer has now been promoted within the army despite calls for his prosecution. What does this say about impunity in Nepal today?
Of the 9,000 cases covered in this archive and in this report, there's not been yet a single prosecution of a human rights violation by either side since the signing of the peace accord. And the danger is all of this is beginning to slip away. The deals are being struck, arrangements are being made, and we begin to see some of the people believed to have perpetrated very serious crimes quietly being promoted or assigned to new positions. We've seen successive governments withdraw cases that were before the Nepali courts to have them withdrawn by the Attorney General. We've also seen the government now begin to at least propose that the Future Truth Commission should have very broad powers to grant amnesty for very serious crimes. Amnesty may have a place for, lower order offences or smaller incidents, but not for crimes of disappearance, crimes of murder, crimes of rape. And we're talking here the rape, of minors, many of them under the age of 15. These are crimes that in international law, in terms of Nepal's own law, in terms of the determinations of Nepal's own Supreme Court, should properly be prosecuted and not be the subject of amnesty.
There were promises in the peace accords for some kind of truth and reconciliation commission. You've referred to it. What's the latest with progress towards that?
Well, a lot of work was done initially. Consultations were held in many parts of the country. There was discussion between the government and victims groups and representatives of victims. And the Constituent Assembly, the legislature in Nepal during this interim period, had actually prepared reasonably good legislation on this. That was never finalised. And now, of course, Nepal is in a little bit of a political conundrum. The timeline for the Constituent Assembly has expired. It no longer exists. It's been wrapped up. The government continues to function in a caretaker mode. And the effort to establish a truth commission had effectively stalled. There have been moves in the last month or two by the government to perhaps set up such a truth commission by ordinance. And in fact, a draft ordinance has been prepared and is awaiting signature by the president. But our concern is that the draft ordinance contains new provisions that would provide very broad amnesty for some of the very serious crimes that occurred during the conflict and that would contravene the intention of the peace agreement and the international obligations Nepal is required to observe.
Rory Mungrovan speaking to Liam Cochrane. Indonesian authorities say they have credible information of a threat for Friday's ceremony to mark the 10th anniversary of the Bali bombings. Australia's Prime Minister Julia Gillard and opposition leader Tony Abbott are among those expected to attend. Indonesian police say security will be intensified at airports and seaports. 202 people were killed in the Bali bombings a decade ago, including 88 Australians. We have this report from George Roberts.
Parading their security muscle, Indonesian authorities took to the grounds of Bali's tactical police headquarters to show any would-be terrorists what they're up against. But just 2 days out from the anniversary of the first Bali attacks, there's a new warning of a new threat. Bali's deputy police chief is Brigadier General Yoga. We consider the indication is serious, he says, so we have to respond seriously to prevent it. Brigadier General Yoga says they've gathered intelligence suggesting efforts are afoot to target Australian VIPs at the memorial this week. Yes, that's the information we've got, he says, and we ask people to be alert. Then, of course, that's become our main job to prevent a serious threat. The Prime Minister Julia Gillard and opposition leader Tony Abbott are expected to attend a memorial service for the 202 people killed. The government's also sponsoring survivors and the families of the 88 Australians killed to attend the service. In a statement, a spokesman for the Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr has acknowledged the threat but refused to give any details, saying,
"The government is unable to comment on security issues before major events, but it is working closely with the Indonesians and is aware of security threats. The Australian government is closely monitoring the situation and taking all relevant precautions."
Bali's governor and the former chief investigator responsible for tracking down the bombers and having them arrested is Imadi Pastika.
Are you aware of these threats?
Yes, that's what I say, the threat is always here, especially when so many people, very important people, come to this island. But I think the security officers are already aware of this and they will take measures on this.
This seems like specific intelligence targeted at the Australian VIPs coming for this event.
I don't think so. Even me, I'm also the target.
What's being done to prevent these further attempts to hit targets?
Yeah, I think they have done already. It's a lot of measures. I understand they have operations, procedures and cooperation between them is already taken. I got information that everything's already settled.
Can you say what's being done?
No.
You don't seem concerned about it.
I'm sorry, but I understand they have been taken so many measures to prevent this.
So you seem quite confident that things will go smoothly?
Yeah, of course.
Indonesian authorities have dedicated a 1,500-strong security force to patrol the area.
A U.S. congressional panel has recommended that two of the world's largest telecommunications companies be effectively shut out of the American market because they pose a threat to national security. The Chinese companies Huawei and ZTE sell products including routers and other internet gear. The United States panel warns the equipment could be used to give the Chinese government access to sensitive American data and critical networks. We have this story from Jane Cowan.
The election season has seen fears of China manipulating its currency and taking American jobs bandied about at every turn. But now there's a new fear. After a year-long bipartisan investigation, the House Intelligence Committee says the Chinese companies Huawei and ZTE can't be trusted, recommending American firms avoid doing business with them, and that the US government ban the use of their components in its computer systems because they could be tampered with in a way that could be used in espionage. Dutch Ruppersberger is the top Democrat on the committee.
We are dealing with a communist country. The communist country has a lot of power over their companies and their people. And what happens if they are networked in here and the ability to be in control of information for our citizens or our companies? And all of a sudden, the Chinese government said, we want you to give us the information.
The Republican chairman of the committee, Mike Rogers, says there have been cases of the Chinese-made equipment acting oddly, including instances of something called beaconing.
It means the processing of information and sending it back unauthorized by the network. So it could be a router who turns on in the middle of the night and starts sending back large data packs, and it happens to be sent back to China. From a consumer's perspective, it could be your medical records, it could be your personal financial data, your personal communications. It could also be intellectual property.
The committee's been especially critical of Huawei, the CEO of which was once a civil engineer for the People's Liberation Army. Committee Chairman Mike Rogers says the companies have failed to allay fears about their links to the Chinese government and military.
In the open hearing, they said that the Huawei particularly said that they would give us both current and past members of the Communist Committee in the company and the scope of their duties and responsibilities. And they said, sure, well, absolutely. When the cameras were on, we're all in. It wasn't very long after that they said, no, we really can't do that. Those kind of red flags just tell you that there's a problem there. Where there is smoke, there is fire.
Huawei is the same company that was disqualified from bidding for work on Australia's national broadband network because of security concerns, a decision the US committee acknowledged multiple times today. But with access to America's growing $30 billion telecommunications market at stake as mobile traffic soars and 4G networks roll out, Huawei spokesman Bill Plummer today condemned the report as a political distraction.
Huawei is Huawei. Huawei is not China. If the U.S. government and this committee have issues with the government of another country around cyber or otherwise, it is their responsibility to manage those issues. It is not fair to hold hostage an independent employee-owned company that is bringing affordable broadband across the planet.
The Intelligence Committee says it's now referring allegations, including that Huawei engaged in fraud and bribery when seeking contracts in the US, to the FBI. In a separate development, the US network equipment maker Cisco Systems has ended a long-standing sales partnership with ZTE. After an internal investigation into accusations, the firm sold Cisco networking gear to Iran.
It was a bad weekend for North Korea. First, a North Korean soldier made a rare dash across the fortified demilitarized zone separating the two Koreas, shooting dead two of his officers before he made the escape. Then, in a move that certainly enraged Pyongyang, Washington finally relented on South Korea's demand to triple its long-range missile system. We have this report from Mark Wallacey.
It's the most heavily militarized border in the world, a 250-kilometer-long, 4-kilometer-wide strip of land lined with razor wire, dotted with tank and anti-personnel mines, and surrounded on both sides by artillery, rockets, and hundreds of thousands of soldiers ready to fight. To cross the demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea is virtual suicide, which is why few have tried. But on the weekend, a North Korean soldier decided to make the dash. A North Korean soldier defected to our guard post in the demilitarized zone at 12:10 p.m., says Colonel Lee Bung-woo of the South Korean Joint Chiefs of Staff. Our army has now raised its military alert in the area, but there have been no extraordinary moves by the North Korean military so far, he says. The defection is a blow to the prestige and reputation of the North's army, and an embarrassment for the country's young leader, Kim Jong-un, because this soldier didn't just make a mad dash for it. To ensure success, he first shot dead his platoon leader and a company commander, before showing up on a driveway on the South Korean side of the western end of the armistice line. Apparently, landmines or razor wire didn't slow him up. A slap in the face to the North may be, but something of far more concern to Pyongyang was announced later in the weekend. For years, South Korea has been arguing for a US-imposed restriction on the range of its rockets to be lifted, arguing the 300-kilometer limit was ridiculous in light of its northern neighbor openly launching ballistic missiles and provocatively boasting a nuclear capability. And now Washington has relented, increasing Seoul's rocket range to 800 kilometers, effectively putting every square centimeter of North Korean territory in the South sights.
우리 정부가 이번에 미사일 지침을 개정한 가장 중요한 목적은
The most important thing about this revision in the missile guidelines is to deter North Korea's provocations, says the South's National Security Advisor Chun Yong-woo. If Pyongyang launches an armed attack or provocation towards us, we can now render its war potential incapable at an early stage, he says. But North Korea isn't the only nation in North Asia exposed to this extension to Seoul's missile reach. South Korean media has quoted diplomatic sources as saying Japan has protested about the move to the United States, fearing some Japanese islands will now come within Seoul's range. The two countries are locked in a bitter territorial dispute over a couple of rocky outcrops occupied by South Korea but claimed by Japan, although no one expects an exchange of rocket fire over them just yet.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is very simple, focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. Stay tuned. In a surprise move, China is not sending its finance minister or other top banking officials to a major international finance meeting in Japan. The IMF and the World Bank are holding their annual meetings in Tokyo for the first time in 50 years. The Chinese withdrawal marks a new stage in the dispute between Beijing and Tokyo over their conflicting territorial claims in the East China Sea. But it also sends a warning to the rest of the world about China and how it chooses to deal with it. Karen Snowden has more.
The head of the Central Bank of China was to lead the large delegation going to Tokyo, along with the finance minister and the heads of the four large state-owned commercial banks. Zhou Chaochun is staying at home. China will be represented instead by his deputy and the deputy finance minister in what is a major snub to Japan, says Sean Ryan, managing director of the China Market Research Group.
This is very clearly a strong warning shot by China's government to really show the Japanese and the rest of the world that China is not going to be bound by Japanese pressure. And it's really to show that China is now the new power in the Asia-Pacific region. And so they're really going to show that power, in this case, trumps economics.
The two countries have conflicting claims to a group of small islands administered by and called Senkaku in Japan and Diaoyu in China. The dispute has been escalating in recent months and is perhaps the most serious of the territorial spats China is having with several of its neighbours. It's been marked by violent protests in China, and Japanese businesses are being affected. Japanese car makers have been hard hit. Sales for Toyota Motors halved in September, with Nissan and Honda suffering similar losses. According to Sean Ryan, the snub by Beijing by not sending its most senior representatives is meant to send a signal beyond Tokyo.
It's also to show the United States and the rest of the world that we can't push China around anymore. You can no longer have American hegemony, and that you now have a second global superpower on the block, and it happens to be in Asia.
That might be the intention. How do you think it's going to be interpreted, first in Japan and then more broadly by the international community?
You're going to see a lot of froth and a lot of anger coming from Japan, from the ultra-nationalists. The global world is going to take a look and probably going to say China's not ready for the prime time to be a true global economic superpower, because the IMF meetings are so important that how can you not have China's lead banker go? You're also going to see people second questioning whether or not the RMB, China's currency, can ever become a reserve currency. So I think it's going to make China look a little bit like a child in the eyes of most of the other central bankers.
The Japanese government says Mr. Zhou's absence is regrettable. 15,000 people will be in Tokyo for the 5 days of meetings of two of the most powerful international financial institutions. The IMF's latest report on the global economy is gloomy reading. Oliver Blanchard is the IMF's chief economist.
In advanced economies, growth is now too low to make a substantial dent in unemployment. And in major emerging markets, growth, which had been strong earlier, has also decreased.
Much hinges on Europe's economic progress. Contained in the IMF's report is a warning that strongly growing emerging economies like China, India and Brazil are also vulnerable to global instability. It's a warning China might not be heeding. Sean Ryan says China's absence in Tokyo is detrimental to it and recovery in the short term.
China's economy is certainly slowing, and you need to have the global policymakers meet and sort of come up with a consensus on how to drive the global economic recovery. And by not going, that definitely is going to put a dent in economic recovery hopes.
Do you think China is listening to those signals?
I'm not sure that China's government is heeding all of the risk warning signals globally, because they're really much more focused on their leadership transition. And they're also very, again, worried about the long-term play of showing that China is more powerful than other nations.
And finally, a Pakistani child activist who was shot by a Taliban gunman, Malala Yousafzai, remains in critical condition after doctors removed a bullet from her head. It's not decided if Malala will be flown to Dubai for further medical treatment. Malala has been lobbying against the Taliban for denying girls the right to education. The attack on her has created an outcry in both Pakistan and around the world. We have this story from Kandahar Sepati.
No terrorist incident in Pakistan has raised the ire of all sectors of the society as the cowardly and brutal shooting of 14-year-old child activist Malala Yousafzai. The Tehreek-e Taliban has claimed responsibility for the critical shooting of Malala for what they say is her secular beliefs and criticism of them for denying girls in the Swat Valley a right to education. Pakistan's President Azif Ali Zardari says the attack on Malala will not weaken the government's determination to support women's education. But others, like MP and women's activist Bushra Goha, says it's time for the government to take on the Taliban.
If our children are no longer safe, we have to review our policies. The recognition that Taliban and Talibanization is our biggest enemy right now.
It's a view shared by Zaman Khan, the spokesman for Pakistan's Human Rights Commission.
The government should dealt with iron hands with the religious extremists and leave no scope for them to grow and continue their terrorist act. They should be very clear, because these terrorists do not enjoy the support of the majority. Majority are against them. It's a small number which is indulging anti-humanity activity.
Qazi Hussein Ahmed is the president of the National Solidarity Council, a non-political organization that brings together all religious groups. He was also the former president of the MMA, a fundamentalist mullah's party. He says such an act goes against the very grain of Pakistani society.
To shoot a woman, and especially a child, this is against our tribal conventions, against Islamic conventions, and against not only our law, but our social system.
Malala Yousafzai began blogging since 2009, expressing her fears at the ongoing conflict between the Taliban and the military forces in her homeland of Swat Valley. She also expressed her frustrations at being denied a right to education. She came to prominence last November when she was awarded Pakistan's first National Peace Prize and was one of five shortlisted children for the International Children's Peace Prize by advocacy group Kids Rights Foundation.
This is an occasion of happiness and pride for me, my friends, my teachers and parents. I'm the first Pakistani girl, first Pakhtun girl, who has been nominated for the award.
But that pride was also tempered by the fear that she could be targeted by the Taliban, one that has become a reality and which Australia's Prime Minister Julia Gillard says should not be condoned.
Today we think of her and we desperately hope that she does not have to pay that price that she spoke of, losing her life. And we should all today join in her resolve to get this work done. If girls' lives anywhere are less than they should be, we are diminished everywhere.
The Taliban controlled much of Swat Valley between 2007 and 2009. And during that time, cleric Maulana Fazlullah presided over a brutal campaign of beheadings, violence and multiple attacks on girls' schools. In 2009, after fierce fighting, the army declared the region back under its control. But the situation there still remains volatile. Qazi Hussein Ahmed says the Taliban does not represent the Islamic values of the people of Swat.
Those people who are working against the education of women, they do not represent the Islamic ideas and Islamic schools of thought. To educate a single woman is to create a school. To educate a man is to educate one person, one individual.
In the face of threats and harassment from the Taliban, it is difficult for the people in Swat to conduct a normal life. Zaman Khan from the Human Rights Commission says the government needs to empower these people.
Create awareness among the people. People are against them, but government must facilitate that the civilian, unarmed people, peace-loving people should be organized and combat with this tiny minority who was dictating the people and blackmailing the people at the gunpoint.
And with that report from Kandahar Sapati, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Powell saying we'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.